Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nivishesha Sunyavari Paschachade Satarane Oma Gyanam Timodandasya Gananjana Shilakaya Chaksur Umiritam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Panchakal Putra Bishakri Pasandevaja Ditanam Bhavanebio Vaishnavebio Namo Namaha. So yesterday we took a look at Lord Chaitanya's hermeneutics and saw where, got an idea where Prabhupada's way of dealing with things actually came from. And then we discussed at least one of the sort of more controversial issues, Prabhupada's statements about the position of women. Anyway, there are many more things to talk about along those lines. But today I think I want to... And we want to show how what Prabhupada is saying, again, you have to take a statement of his and first of all understand it in terms of the whole purpose. As Prabhupada had said to Professor Stahl, you have to know what the goal is and the aim is and then understand statements and apparently contradictory statements in terms of the entire, and assume that the Vedic texts are a whole. They're a coherent whole. That's not what modern scholars believe, but that's Prabhupada's principle. And so in that way we can see Prabhupada has a project, one that was instituted by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and that of the idea of to some extent, the restoration of the system of Varnashram Dharma as the platform for cultivating devotional service, favorable devotional service, and for also solving many problems in the world, according to him. And so if many things that Prabhupada says that seemed against ago are experience or sense perception, or our ideas, social ideas, if you see them in terms of where Prabhupada is going, they make a lot more sense. And I don't know how many of us really want to place our faith in the continuing advancement of industrial civilization. This brings us into today's topic. Most of us don't, because we are now at a time where the results of the project in Europe that really sort of began in the Enlightenment with the Industrial Revolution is reaching an era, a place where we can see many, many difficulties. And Prabhupada very much tells us all the time that this modern economy, the industrial civilization, is artificial and that it will come to an end. It's just a matter of time. In some form or another, it will come to an end. I do not think that I envision a return to the Middle Ages exactly, but something. So there will be some very, very drastic change. So we are under these particular conditions now, and Prabhupada was clear that he wanted to set up an alternative way of life to the modern idea. He said we are not against the material advancement of civilization, but if it is harmful to God realization, then we reject it. So that's the basis on which you could actually ultimately deindustrialize to a reasonable level. When we come to so we are now in the modern world. I mean, this is the modern world, and the entry of our tradition and its confrontation with the modern world and the modern West, the crucial figure with whom that began was Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and he was the first one to confront the alternative hermeneutics of Western historical thinking and critical scholarship, as well as certain Enlightenment ideas, which were then become very, very well established among a high class of intellectuals in Calcutta, who went by the name of, the name for them was Bhadralok. The most famous of these is like Rabindranath Tagore and others. These are people who are educated, usually of Brahminical backgrounds, but not all of them, and very much under the influence of Western liberal ideas, political, social, economic, and scientific ideas, brought by the British to India. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur belonged to this group of Bhadralok. He was connected by family connections. He grew up in a village, but finally went to Calcutta and then was trained and educated with these people. And they were quite uprooted, alienated from their traditional Indian and Hindu roots. The modern uprooted intellectual, these were these people. And so Bhaktivinoda Thakur came from this group of people, and there was among them, some of them, a rather wholesale rejection of Hinduism. Out of them came the Brahmo Samaj, which was basically Bankim Chandra Chatterjee and the rejection of almost every part of Vedic tradition, Hindu tradition, deity worship, and a sort of Unitarian liberal Protestant Christianity was there. Highly critical of traditional Indian culture, as were the British. And also really captivated by this notion, quite alien to traditional Indian thought, of progress. This idea of progress, which was something that this notion that humanity is progressing. I gave a seminar here a few years ago called Modern Historical Consciousness, which I traced back this idea of progress on the grounds of a book called The Great Chain of Being by Arthur Lovejoy, one of the founders of the Histories of Ideas. And he shows how the medieval hierarchical universe, with God at the top and then down by degrees of beings all the way down to the lowest thing in the universe, this is the hierarchy, and everything's connected by this great chain of being, which is also basically the same structure that we get from Bhagavatam, from Prabhupada. That sometime in the 18th century, something happened in European thought, and Lovejoy calls it the temporalization of the chain of being. Instead of being oriented in this direction, you know, from the top to the bottom of the universe, starting with God, it turns on its axis and then becomes the idea of going upward from some obscure origin to some future state of perfection. And this idea of this is what was happening was actually in the works long before there was a formal scientific theory of evolution. It was the scientific theory of evolution grew out of this kind of thinking. This was the prior idea. So, of course, this was then used. It became very big in the 19th century when people saw the technological advancement that began to be released by the Industrial Revolution as proof that there is progress, and that the human race has come from some kind of ape-like creatures to the primitive people that we were busy conquering in various backwards parts of the world, and bringing the light of civilization and They were useful for slave labor, but nothing else. So this was the sort of triumphalism of European civilization that justified the colonial domination of the world, and the social Darwinism that went with it. So this was a very very big leading idea. So during Bhaktivinoda Thakur's time, it was very hard. This was the idea that was in the atmosphere. You didn't see it anywhere else. And up until when I was a kid growing up, we were also taught progress. We took it in with our mother's milk. We used to watch television, and General Electric used to put on a famous TV show once a week, some kind of drama. And there was the commercial for General Electric, and their slogan was, "Remember, progress is our most important product." You know? Yeah, and Ronald Reagan was their announcer. That's right. Later on, the President of the United States, just to prove that progress was. But this idea has now begun to fall apart. Western civilization has become self-critical. And this is called in philosophy postmodern. We are now in the postmodern era. So things have changed quite a bit. And no longer, not all of us, are so self-confident in the future progress. The damage that has been done to native cultures, indigenous cultures and indigenous people, the damage that has been done to the environment, and the damage that has been done to ourselves by all this progress has now begun to become noted. And people are wondering what we are going to do. The global warming is only the latest of a long series of things. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur's confrontation was with modernity was when it was at its triumphalist peak, I think. Things began to change in 1914 in Europe. I mean, that was really the beginning of the disillusionment with the outbreak of the Great War. That wasn't supposed to happen. That did not look like progress to people. And that war continued until 1945 with a brief lull. Basically, Europe tore itself apart. This before then, people were really very, very confident in the idea of progress. Very, very confident. Why this has become an issue with us with Bhaktivinoda Thakur is Shukavak Das, a godbrother of mine, who took an undergraduate degree in Sanskrit, then later on did a PhD dissertation, studied Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and this is his book, which you've seen. It's all around ISKCON, Hindu Encounter with Modernity. That's his theme, examining Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And especially Shukavak discovered, two things. One is Bhaktivinoda Thakur's autobiography, which had been privately printed by his son, Lalit Prasad, a very small circulation. But the main thing for our purposes is this book written very early on. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you have to understand, was a convert from modernity and his family was Vaishnava, but he grew up with Shaktas, worshippers of Durga or Kalima, and went on a spiritual search and basically became converted to Krishna consciousness, to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. But almost at the very beginning of his encounter, long before he was ever initiated and before he was even following all the principles, because of the nature of his mentality, he immediately saw very deeply into Krishna consciousness, and immediately the first thing he wanted to do was to bring it to his social circle, the Bhadralok, with their leading ideas, because he saw among them just a wholesale rejection or thinning out of Indian spiritual tradition. But he was now convinced here was the real thing. But they wouldn't even look at it. They wouldn't look, wouldn't even consider it. So he wrote this work that we all know, the Bhagavat, very early on, which was a lecture that he gave to those kinds of people, some Western people, but mostly these educated Calcutta intellectuals, the Bhadralok. Technically, in religious discourse, that's called apologetics. There's different kinds of writings. One is polemics, when you attack somebody's position. One is apologetics, where you try to show how your own is reasonable. Another is irenics, where you try to make peace. This is apologetics. It doesn't mean you're apologizing in the modern sense of the term, but you're explaining yourself and showing how the charges against you are false, and that actually what you're doing is very good and reasonable, and if people just understood you, they would like you. Those kinds of things. So this the Bhagavat is apologetics. And about the same time, in 1838, he wrote a book called... is that the right date? No, it's wrong, is it? 1868. He wrote this Krishna Samhita. And the Krishna Samhita is very unusual because in the very beginning part of the Krishna Samhita, the second part is a discussion of Krishna's Leela and his meaning and how to understand them that is quite compatible with what we know from Srila Prabhupada. But the very first part, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, now I will try to understand the Vedas and the Bhagavatam and Vedic history according to what he calls the Adunika Vada. The Vada means the teachings or the outlook. Aduna means today, the modern approach, you could translate it. Shukavak translates it as the modern approach. I think more better way to translate it is the currently fashionable approach. According to the currently fashionable approach. According to modern opinion. Now, Shukavak has given us, in a way... The reason this study then advocates Bhaktivinoda Thakur's approach for all of us. It makes a case that actually we are now ourselves, those who are trained in ISKCON in a traditional way, we are now confronting modernity, just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur did. And so now he's shown the way how to do this. And the difficulty that presents for us is that he does things that Prabhupada says we shouldn't do. He accepts definitely and clearly one half a hint. In other words, there's things in the Vedas about this world and there's things in the Vedas about transcendence. We accept what it says about transcendence, but as far as what's in this world, we just try to understand that according to the... what we scientifically know today. It's the half a hin sort of a thing. You pick and choose what you like. In other words, you become the authority and so on. But this is a little compelling for us because this is all done by... It's hard to get a little outraged about it since some of the words are Bhaktivinoda Thakur's words. If it's Shukavak saying it, you know, we can blast the guy and say, you know, Prabhupada says, Puma Bhaktivinoda Thakur says it. We have to, wow, wait a minute, you know. Because Shukavak himself found this approach of Bhaktivinoda Thakur the solution to a personal dilemma. And So he says in his prologue, from the outset, I was confronted with the problem of applying my acquired Vaishnava outlook within a modern context. Could I play a meaningful role in modern society and at the same time maintain integrity as a Vaishnava? It appeared that I was confronted with two great worlds. One was the modern and secular world that I had grown up in, which demanded rational thought and conformity to standards that seemed godless and uncompromising. The other was a traditional world of Vaishnava faith and piety, which seemingly allowed little room for critical thought. The two worlds appeared mutually exclusive, and I soon discovered that I had two conflicting identities, the modern rational thinker and the old world Vaishnava. So that's his personal dilemma. So he says his first attempt was just to immerse himself in the Vaishnava world of 500 years ago and just deny his modern roots and background and everything. But somehow he discovered in a trip to India that in the deepest core of his being, he was a modern guy. He was a product of the modern world, and to deny that was to become dishonest. On the other hand, I felt that Vaishnava faith, with its ancient traditions, did indeed have something important to offer, something which I dearly wanted. Before I could have it, I needed to reconcile these two opposing views. And so he talks to this, so he says, my need to integrate tradition and modernity eventually led to my study of Kendranath Bhaktivinoda, 1838. Yeah, he was born in 1838. So the other one that was written sometime when he was about 30, 1914, who during his own lifetime faced a similar predicament. So while Shukavak is a scholar, and quite a good scholar, he also has his personal spiritual crisis that he's trying to solve. And I am not following him in his way of solving it myself. I think if you just look at what I just read, you will discover already how he solved it. He tells us his the personal background, which is nice that he did that. You know, that's part of modern. What is characteristic of modern thinking is this what they call critical self-awareness. That's what you learn in academics more than anything else. It teaches critical self-awareness. And that when you're thinking something, you're also aware of what position you're thinking from, so you always are conscious of yourself as a thinker and subjecting what you own do to doubt. So he does this, he shows us. But I'm afraid, I don't think he goes far enough, in my judgment anyway. I have to say that Shukavak, for many years, is a personal friend of mine. I know him quite well, and we know we disagree on this matter. We've had discussions about it. But notice when he describes the two different worlds here in this preface. The one is characterized by rational thought, reason, and the other by faith and piety. So here you have, you know, the polarity is set up, faith versus reason. Now, that description of the difference between the modern approach and a traditional approach is the description from within the modern context. I mentioned, I think, our first class, I also had the same confrontation. I was already within the modern context as an academic, and I ran across Krishna consciousness, and I saw it as two self-contained wholes. I saw it as a choice I had to face. Which one do I take? To me, my realization was that this was ultimately a leap of faith. Because if I made a choice, the choice between the modern view and the view, the Krishna conscious view, were so inclusive that if I wanted to justify the choice, any grounds I could have for saying why I did this rather than that, the grounds were included in one side or the other. And so it was a naked choice. You know, if I accepted the modern approach, I could then say, well, you know, these people, they didn't have scientific knowledge about the world, and of course they did have certain emotional experiences, but everybody interprets it according to their own nature, you know, and I could deal with the absolute sort of claims of Krishna consciousness in that way. And there are many, many religions, and we live in this pluralistic universe, you know, I mean, if I choose Krishna consciousness, I mean, oh yeah, you know, those people are in Maya, they're completely deluded by the bewildering energy, you know, but before making the choice, where are the grounds? There are no grounds, you know. And if you confront a choice like that, it put me, and I think it puts anyone, into a very profound existential crisis. That's quite terrifying. And the only way I can explain why I choose what I did is by saying to you, Krishna appeared. Super Soul appeared and said that, and once he showed up, that was it. that's what happened to me. It was a leap of faith. But the other thing, as I realized, is to go the other way would also be a leap of faith. It wasn't just it was faith on this side and reason on that side. No way. It was faith versus faith. Which faith? And that's why I say, you see, when I saw this as faith versus faith, I was being postmodern. Of course, most postmodern thinkers just go and dissolve themselves into complete relativism, but that's another thing. We have our own particular brand of postmodernism. but Shukavak, when he says faith versus reason, is in the modern context. And he has accepted... He has basically accepted the modern framework and then made room for some form of Krishna consciousness within it, which the modern framework does. It doesn't necessarily mean... The whole thing, as modern relativism has been developed, is to leave room for religious faith and pluralism. But it's relegated to its special little cubbyhole in reality. So you see, this is the way that he has made it in the course of whatever he was confronting. He made his decision, and so you can just see by the way he describes his dilemma that he made his choice, and now is explaining from within one of those other frameworks. So to me, the challenge is. And I don't say that I've met up, you know, fulfilled this challenge, is to explain the choice from this framework. I also want to unify the two choices. There's no doubt about it. I do not think that we can pull ourselves back into a fundamentalist shell and explain that and pretend the world isn't out there. I think this is one of the characteristics of fundamentalism is just that you just... do not take the other approach at all seriously. You dismiss it, and you do not even listen to what they have to say. I don't think we should do that, and I don't think Prabhupada wanted us to do that. That's why he had such things as the Bhaktivedanta Institute. Prabhupada was confident that we could confront them and not just survive, but prevail. I think that was Prabhupada's our assignment from Prabhupada, because when I wrote him, what do you think I should write my doctoral dissertation on? He suggested I defeat Darwin. The very strong characteristic of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's analysis according to the modern perspective in the beginning of the Krishna Samhita. It basically accepts an evolutionary view of society and the idea of progress. It's very strongly there. And Prabhupada told us to defeat it. That was the assignment. he wanted to do it. And when I think about what Prabhupada said, I understand. Prabhupada gave his way he wins arguments. Prabhupada said he said, when I attack an opponent, I find his weak point, and then I hammer and hammer and hammer and hammer until he dies. And so his thing was to look for that weak point, find it, and then go for it. It was very traditional, actually, martial arts. Your vulnerable point. It's called a marma. Like the last of the Shishastika prayers, marma hatam karotuva, he may bring me brokenhearted. Actually, the literal meaning of the Sanskrit, marma, means those points in the body which are vulnerable. You know, you have a chart where to shoot the arrow or where to hit them with the judo chop. That's a marma. And that poem, Radharani's saying, he's got me in that, that marma. Anyway, that's Prabhupada's method. So he decided, Prabhupada's decision has been, and maybe before Prabhupada also, that this evolution was the point. That was the point. And I could see that if somehow or other Darwin or whatever version of him is current would actually be discredited and defeated. Where would people, you know, what would, then you look around and you say, where have we come from? How did we get here? And you have to say, we haven't got the faintest idea. You know, you have to live your life with a frame around it, sort of, you know, the cosmic background, but some picture, however vague it may be, of what it's like. And right now, everybody's picture, well, you know, there was this big bang out there, and then something happened, things got more complicated, and here we are, and, you know, that explains why we're here. But imagine just looking at the world, and you don't know. You have no, you're just here. There's this thing going on called history, and you're in the middle of it. And you've got no idea. You see, that it would put the whole contemporary mentality just would be up for grabs. People have to have something. They have to have something. So I understood this is what this was the marma, you know, this was the point of attack, the Schwerpunkt, that's where you hit them, you know. But we see with Bhaktivinoda Thakur a different tactic that he took. Now the thing to notice about this is that when he writes this, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is very careful in the way he says things. He says, I am doing this for those who accept the modern approach. Unfortunately, I left my copy of the Krishna Samhita at home. I didn't mean to do that. So I'll have to... Oh, now I couldn't find it. You know, I have my markings. I realized I could get one, but I'm all marked up. Let me see if I have it here somewhere. No, it would take me too long to find the place I'm looking for. Yeah, but here's an example from Shukavak. How just when this pure Vaishnava Dharma arose, and how it developed in our country has to be determined. But before we discuss this, we must discuss many other topics. Therefore, we will begin by the dates of the most important historical events of Indian history, according to modern opinion, the currently fashionable outlook. Then we will determine the dates of the many respected books. So, you know, he concludes that Bhagavatam was written in South India sometime around, you know, 900 AD, and, you know, all those kinds of things. As we fix the dates of these texts, we will determine the history of Vaishnava Dharma. Whatever seems clear according to modern opinion, we will discuss. We examine time according to the ancient methods, but for the benefit of people today, we will rely upon the modern conventions. So, I mean, that just gives away, I think, what he's doing. It's sort of a, Okay, let's do it. And especially the people who he was preaching to, you all accept this. So now I'm going to do this. If this the Vedic outlook to you is so absurd and so ridiculous and so primitive that you won't have anything to do with it, okay, we'll leave this aside, but let's go to what it's really about, which is about developing love of God. Okay. And especially he was concerned that people take this seriously because part of what's called rational thinking was a certain things that have nothing to do with rationality, but basically Victorian morality. And it was that, you know, Krishna's character was suspect. This is from the Christian missionaries rather than from any rational enlightened thing. But that Krishna as a person who enjoyed with many men's wives, only a backward, debased, and debauched people could possibly worship such a degenerate as God. And this was Christian missionary propaganda. And so he wanted to show that actually what's going on is entirely different. It's not that kind of a thing. And so then to get them to reconsider all this, this is his tactic that he takes. When it comes to dealing with Krishna Leela, the other thing he accepts is many of the ways this dealing of scripture of the art, you know, take out the spiritual essence and the phenomenal shell, the worldly part you can reject. He definitely was appealing to people who were very much under the influence of that list of names in the beginning of the Bhagavata, Channing, Parker, Newman, and Emerson. That is to say, Unitarian liberal Christians. Liberal Christianity had one thing that Bhaktivinoda Thakur liked very much, and that was this universality of outlook. Unlike the Christian missionaries they had been subjected to, who said, you know, this is the way, and you know, if you're not accepting Jesus, you know, you're going to hell, and Hinduism is a creation of the devil. This was always a Christian outlook. Gibbons makes fun of it in the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. You know, he describes how the early Christians they would drive out devils out of people. They would go around and exorcise people of the devils, and when the devils would come out, the devils would inevitably announce, "Actually, I'm Phoebus Apollo, and that's my temple over there on that hill, right there." So that other religions were basically that the demons all over the world, Satan's helpers, had all taken the guise of gods and induced people to worship them. This was a traditional. The more generous spirit, which recognized spiritual experiences outside of that tradition, were quite welcomed by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. But then the claim is turned around to say that he was influenced by this. And here comes the idea that, well, you know, although he's a great devotee, still he belongs to his time and place and circumstances. And so he was influenced by Unitarian Christianity. I don't think that's what happened. I think he saw something in there that may have attracted him. He looked into Vaishnava tradition. It's in Vaishnava tradition. So, yeah, we accept that. I think that's a different thing from importing it from the outside, if that's what you mean by influence. I think we can take all kinds of things from different places if they are compatible with Krishna consciousness. That judgment has to be there. I mean, Prabhupada, just to give you an example of Prabhupada's preaching tactics, at one of the early Rathiatras, he mentioned, he said that Jagannath has come to the West because of Jesus. And Jesus was a devotee of Jagannath because he read this book called The Aquarian Gospel of Jesus Christ. This was a book making its way around the hippie circuits in those days, which is written by somebody, I guess the name was Apphias Levy, who read from the Akashic Record the history of what Jesus did in his years after, before, you know, when he was the missing years of Jesus, is that he went to India and participated in the Rath Yatra, but also criticized the Brahmins at the Jagannath Temple. So anyway, Prabhupada said that, he said that Jesus Christ was a devotee of Jagannath. So the devotees afterwards said to Prabhupada, they're a little disturbed about this. And they said, is this Aquarian gospel? Is that bona fide, Srila Prabhupada? Prabhupada thought for paused for a minute. He said, well, if the conclusion is nice, why not? So sometimes for preaching purposes you can do different things and adapt different things, but anyway, what you accept, our own tradition remains the standard, and sometimes you may find something that somebody from another tradition, they've expounded very well, and when you look and you see, yeah, it's actually in our own tradition, and maybe I never even noticed it before. I think that's all quite legitimate. But anyway, Bhaktivinoda Thakur then expounds in this way, according to these people, the modernism, liberal Christianity was a response. Remember, Darwin's book came out in the 1860s, I think. So that was like the big thing then. People were really beginning, it was quite a shock. And what they call liberal Christianity arose over that controversy. It was particularly whether you're going to accept this view of creation or the traditional view of creation. And the Unitarians were the leaders, this Emerson, Channing, Parker, Newman, not John Henry Cardinal Newman, another Newman, who was a Episcopalian or Anglican. These were the ones that Bhaktivinoda Thakur had read and studied, and they were all studying this. So he wanted to, from those, so that was a little, that breadth of outlook was a little welcome. So he really wanted to, his idea was to sort of get people to understand what Lord Krishna is about, what's really going on. And he did not become a Mayavadi when he did this, because if you take the usual liberal Christian way of thinking and you say, well, the inspiration comes from God, but the scriptures are all man-made and reflect human thoughts and so on, then pretty much you empty everything out of content. All content becomes empty, and the transcendental part that remains is, here he quotes, here's one, this is Parker, Theodore Parker. In actual Christianity, that is, in that portion of Christianity which is preached and believed, there seems to have been, ever since the time of its earthly founder, two elements, the one transient, meaning passing, temporary, and the other permanent. The one is the thought, the folly, the uncertain wisdom, the theological notions, the impiety of man, the other, the eternal truth of God. So that they say that, something comes down from God, but immediately as soon as the human beings get it, they muck it up with their fallen thoughts, with their impermanent ideas, their temporary thinking, and so on like that. So we have to separate out what's eternal and true from what's temporary. Well, who's doing the sorting out? The same guys that are causing the trouble to begin with, right? So I don't see a solution here, but anyway. There's a lot to be criticized with this project, but so anyway, those are the people who now Bhaktivinoda Thakur are applying to, and so this is this one section of the Krishna Samhita, but he does adopt something you will not see in any other traditions, liberal traditions of that time. That is that the descriptions of Krishna's Leela are not merely symbols. They're not human creations to point to something beyond some abstract clouds moving around somewhere, but they actually describe real lila of real people. And he gives a very good something, you know, same kind of thing when I was thinking this thing through theologically, that there's actual meaning, and that the words here somehow relate to the what's going on up there, but the true meaning will not be revealed until we are purified. He comes to a similar sort of an idea like that. The thing I want to point out is that having done this at this one part of this one book, Bhaktivinoda Thakur never does it again. Bhak admits that to me. It was a one-time thing. And later on in his many songs, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has many bad things to say about mundane knowledge. We don't see anymore that he gives it so much credit in his various... he said it's a product of Maya, basically, as we are all taught. So, I guess that's as much as I need to go into. That's the basic framework of what happens in there. So, now the interesting thing is, of course, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is three spiritual masters back. Four for some of us, in our line of the civic succession. And we do not see that this particular line of thought that was there at one particular juncture of early in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's spiritual career is picked up and passed on by anyone, by Gaur Kishore Das Babaji, of course not him, but not by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, certainly not by Srila Prabhupada. You don't see it. It just, like it never happened. And in fact, from Srila Prabhupada, we got quite contrary instructions. So what to make of this? And what I make of it, I think if you can take the same text, and if I don't have a need, a particular need myself to reconcile tradition and modernity in this way, I don't have to read it. There's definitely an alternative reading that this was something Bhaktivinoda Thakur did as a sort of thought experiment and as a device to get a hearing for purposes of at least getting his foot in the door with a certain group of people. And in the same way that it's reported that when the sannyasis who first went to London from the Gaudiya mission reported to Bhaktisiddhanta that they refused to be vegetarians, he said, feed them meat. So this is meat. He's feeding them. I myself see the same thing. Feed them. They won't listen? Then do whatever you can, but get your foot in the door. I see we are now in a different time. As I said, the self-confidence of the West, its belief in progress, is running out of steam. Even today, there has been over the last 20 years in the field of biology a very, very difficult undertaking to rewrite the theory of evolution without the idea of progress in it. I mean, the whole original thing was so embedded in this idea of progress. So now it's been recognized where this idea of progress has come from, and especially the social Darwinist aspect was very vital to this notion. It was to justify that white Europeans were more advanced than anyone else along the evolutionary path, and this was now seen to be somewhat of a biased view. And extremely self-serving, and so now we're going to try to say there's evolution, but there is no progress. I haven't really delved into this myself, but I imagine there's quite a lot of double talk because the mechanism is supposed to be somehow you're more fit in some way or another. So they're trying to get rid of that one too, you know. So The idea of progress is even being removed from this, and the idea of a direction to evolution. Now I guess everybody's just sort of milling around. you could devolve now, I suppose. And the self-confidence of the West is running out of steam. So Prabhupada very clearly gave us a different kind of mission. And what he's telling us is that you cannot separate out like this. The idea that somehow what describes a phenomenal world you can reject, but what's transcendental, that's inviolable. Every time I start to think of this, then I think, okay, is Mahavishnu transcendental? Well, okay. Well, then Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. Well, maybe. What about the ocean of the Garbha ocean? Is that there? No, well, there's no Garbha ocean. Then he's not floating on the Garbha ocean. Then what about the bed? Well, we don't know about that bed that he's on. And what about the lotus? So there's no Lord Brahma. Then what about the Brahma Samhita? What about the four essential verses of the Bhagavatam? You just start to unravel. Demigods? No demigods, right? So what about Krishna coming from time to time to destroy the enemies of Indra, if Indra's not there and has no enemies, you know? I mean, every time I start to separate this out, and our philosophy is that the material and spiritual world, after all, are not, you know, in Christianity, there is this notion of a sort of a gap, you know? There's an ontological gap, maybe even more so in Islam, according to what I've heard. The creation out of nothing and all this other kind of stuff. And God, you know, the way my professor Ishmael Al-Faruqi says, he says, the world is totally mundane, secular, and profane. It has no contact with God whatsoever except one time, the Quran. That's it. You know? So Christianity, sort of that out of the same cultural milieu, has a little more connection, but not much. But our philosophy, man, God is in the middle of the thing all the time. He comes and comes and comes, you know. And whew. Anyway, this notion, I find it very, very difficult to. Because you, anyway, it, if even if you say, okay, we're going to try, there's going to be an awful lot of judgment calls. Is this mundane or is this transcendental? Well, no, it's this, no, it's that. And you watch how many different versions of Krishna consciousness you get. And who is the authority? Who is the authority? I'm the authority. We are warned that that only a Mahajana can follow in the... can imitate a Mahajana, huh? If Bhaktivinoda Thakur decided to do this, I think that it's not something that anybody else... should necessarily imitate. So for these reasons, I am not currently in favor of this approach. But I think we will probably hear more of it. We'll have to get into it. We will have to get into it. So maybe we should stop this exposition. I think I made the... I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur saw the mission at that time to sort of get Krishna consciousness established within a kind of world intellectual culture and find a foothold in a place where right now, the West looked invincible. At least the idea was to survive, huh? But our idea is different. Prabhupada wants us to prevail. And that's the order we've been given from him. And I think we should carry it out. Yes, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna. I want to thank you very, very much for going for this first day and also the other days. And I thought it was very good and important how you explain the different approach Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's approach on one occasion and one book, one time only. This book has made it into, at least I know from the place where I preach, many devotees in the Bible. Yes, because of what happened to our hierarchical system, men on the top had different reorientation. Now, I have two very important questions regarding this approach. See this, you have told about Bhaktivinoda Thakur's reading of the demons in Krishna Leela. You have said Bhaktivinoda Thakur made it very clear that it is not analogical, but it is to be taken as it is. Mm-hmm. However, we know that Bhaktivinoda Thakur did explain the symbolic by saying that Bhutana represents a certain anatta, and he even says there are certain anattas. How to get rid? You meditate about this leela and pray to either Krishna and in some cases Balaram to help you. I think that this came out many of the lots of details jumped on this. Is that now? Can we accept that this symbolic dimension, well, or is it?
Why not? Because something has a symbolic significance, or even this is more than symbolic, it's curative. It has curative potency. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. Scripture text may have many different meanings, layers and layers of meanings. So something happens, but because Krishna makes it happen, what happens means something and illustrates something and shows something. And you could say he did it so that people would hear these pastimes and be purified. So I don't think that just because there's a symbolic or allegorical dimension to it means that it's fiction. You want to add something to that, Maharaj, in the back?
One question that sometimes people do act in ways which are deliberately symbolic.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too. Yeah.
That's
a symbolic act, right?
Apart from that, maybe you remember this letter, I think it was, to Krishnadas. We have Godhead and Krishnadas, who's one of the first devotees in Germany, and American devotee came to Germany. And at a certain point, he was in Prabhupada's association with having doubts about just so many things. And he asked whether these pastimes could be taken as allegorical. And as I recall, Prabhupada said, for you, it can be allegorical. You know, if you want to take it that way, okay, for you, it's allegorical.
Want me to look it up?
I'll look it up on you.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to buy it, but if it helps you out.
Yeah, if that's, you know, that's what it takes for you to take it, you know. Go ahead, Mars. What's your second question? Okay, but you had a question up here.
I have a second question.
I understand. But but your attention is now fixed on finding something.
No, no, this is very vague with you. Mm-hmm. No, I can't find it. No way.
Another question from this. It's not really only a book, it's a whole thought stream. It's, I think in the book, I remember I read it one time, the book, and there's a description of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's analysis of different types of faith. And the commercial.
Yeah, it's in the same book. It's the same
Krishna Samhita.
Yes. The Kama, that's a very important part of this presentation of Shukla Bhakti.
Yeah, it is.
It's a very important part, and it's also a very important discussion, really. The point is that the Kama Shraddha, weak Shraddha,
these people have soft faith, yeah.
Soft faith, they are absolutely dependent on the literal explanation of the verb. Mm-hmm. And then it gets Madhya, and finally, Uttam, where there is a Sahaja realization,
yeah.
Direct realization, means direct realization, it has nothing to do with Sahajiya in the book. Then this literal meaning is no longer important. You see the spirit of the thing.
Right. That's right.
And of course, now please deal, you remember this?
Yeah, sure.
Now please deal with this. What do you say to this?
The truth, well, one thing I want you to notice is that the Majjhima are all the Bajralok, by the way. You know, any intellectual with critical intelligence is a Majjhima. So the Komala Shraddha is basically a fundamentalist without really much critical awareness, right? And has to depend upon. But the Majjhima, he doubts everything and questions everything and is more intelligent and everything like that. So my first point is Bhaktivinoda Thakur is flattering his audience with this description. And wants them to say that even though you have this critical intelligence and you're not a simple, stupid fundamentalist, still, you can accept it because you're broad-minded, you look at other people's point of view, you see what they have to see. And the actual people that have attained everything, they have a spiritual vision, a direct spiritual vision of God, which is really what it's about. And so don't worry so much about the literal meaning and whether you know it's different. Don't worry, because what we're really going through is not just propositional truth, but something else, a spiritual experience. He's right. He's right. When one has direct face-to-face encounter with God, in my view, it doesn't mean that the scripture becomes obsolete. Actually, now you find out what it's really saying. Tell me something. Is Srimad Bhagavatam, is Krishna and Krishna's name the same? It is. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says this in this very same book. Then is Srimad Bhagavatam and Krishna the same? It is. How are you going to pick Krishna apart? He can't be picked apart because he has a spiritual form. There are no parts, or every part is the whole, and so on. You can't do it. By our theology, you can't do it. And I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur knows it. So to my mind, if you may think, okay, now I can have the essence, and now I'm beyond scripture, I throw them away, I use scripture to climb up to this place beyond words, beyond thought, beyond meaning, I throw them away, you know. That's not exactly what happens. That's not exactly what happens. And we don't see that's the way Bhaktivinoda Thakur acted with regard to scripture. So that's what I think he's using the distinction, which of course we know where it comes from, in a particular way to get people into Srimad Bhagavatam who otherwise would not. It's a little tricky. It is a little tricky. That's what he did. Is that okay?
Could not follow so fast in the thinking. Why is Krishna identical with the name?
Oh, because Krishna and Krishna's name are the same. So Bhagavatam is really a name of Krishna, is basically a description of Krishna's pastimes. So Bhagavatam is pretty much that. It's the description of Krishna, Krishna's avatars, and Krishna's devotees. Bhagavatam is also none different from Krishna, according to Srila Prabhupada. It has the same status as the name. So if you have the realization that comes from Bhagavatam, when you see Krishna, as we discussed in the very first thing, you see Krishna in every page in Bhagavatam, does Bhagavatam then become discarded because, yeah, this is the real thing and that's not the real thing? No, because you've realized the identity of Krishna in Bhagavatam. And it may be, and the same thing would be there, that basically when you realize Krishna Leela, you understand what those words really mean, because the true meaning of the words that describe Krishna really apply there, and what you see down here is a transformation of that, a dim reflection. So the same thing about Bhagavatam. So my conclusion is that what looks like the world we see now is not really the world either. I don't think until you see God you really see the world either. Because after all, Krishna includes the world. That's our philosophy. And this sort of distinction between the material and spiritual that the Unitarians found so helpful, I don't think will help us. Not unless we change our very fundamental theology, like achincha beta beta tattva. Yeah?
So in the beginning, you were talking about Shukla's crisis, spiritual crisis.
Yeah, he describes it. Yeah.
The first reason, and you thought you didn't go far enough, or maybe it was a false dilemma, or...
No, that isn't exactly what I said. It's not a crisis of faith versus reason. It's not that there's reason on one side and faith on the other. It's that we have one kind of faith on one side and another kind of faith on the other side. Don't you think there's reason in Krishna consciousness?
Yeah.
Of course, there's tons of it. There always has been. And everybody has faith in something. That's the thing. And the people who think, yeah, we have reason and knowledge, it's okay. All processes of knowledge are based on faith. That's okay. But
describing, essentially, it sounded like what Bhagavan Thakur was doing then was kind of preaching tactics or prayer.
That's my understanding of it. Yeah.
I didn't get that when I read the book.
Well, I did. So.
I mean, do you think we should be aware of that?
I'm sure he's aware. Yeah, I'm sure he's aware of that way of understanding it, because I've told him. You know, I think many devotees have probably told him, this is a way we understand it. But he doesn't accept that.
So was he saying that Bhaktivinoda was actually trying to reconcile Eastern and Western
ideology? Yeah, right. And that somehow or other, you can practice Krishna consciousness, at least certain parts of it. You can do Ashtakalya Leela and get involved in Vrindavan pastimes of Krishna and meditation and all those kinds of things. And say at least this much about Krishna I take very, very seriously. But many other things I don't, including most of the avatars, expansions, if Krishna did Krishna narrate Bhagavad Gita to the sun god, millions of years ago or not? Well, if there was no sun god and so on, that's against the modern view. The whole thing falls apart. So it seems like the at least the authority of the Bhagavad Gita is gone. And then when Arjuna says, I accept everything you say is true, we have to understand that in some special way. What I accept as true is the spiritual parts, and so on. So somehow that doesn't bother you, and you go on doing your thing, and you can do that.
This is why you feel people who came after, including Shri Prabhupada, did not refer to this.
Yes, of course. And Bhaktisiddhanta says one. Anyway, our philosophy is that there's a parampara, and Prabhupada has warned us many times as you receive it as it comes down the chain, you do not attempt to jump over acharyas to go back to the past. And that for the particular time and place, the expert knows what medicine to give. So there's the question of fidelity to Prabhupada. Certainly fidelity to Prabhupada means we don't go in that direction. Of that there's no question. But what you can question is whether we should be so faithful to Srila Prabhupada. After all, there are many acharyas, lots of kinds of Gaudiya Vaishnavas around. They say, go off in that direction too. So I wanted to give at least an explanation of what Prabhupada conceives of our mission as being. And part of that mission is the furtherance of the very mission that Bhaktivinoda Thakur wants to accomplish, which is the reestablishment of some kind of Vedic culture, which would definitely mean the end of modernism in the modern world as it stands now. That definitely that would mean that. And I think the people that take this other approach may not be able to be so active in that cause. Maharaj,
that's actually, I want to thank you for giving that perspective, because it really did affect me when I read it.
I can tell.
You know, when he's reaching out to Emerson and Channing and Parker and Stella Transcendental.
Yeah, isn't that nice? I love that approach. You know, I really do. I think we should do things like that. We should look across the cultures and the denominations, and we see somebody's on a spiritual path. We should talk to them about what we have in common, and we should. I think there's a lot to be done along the line. I don't think that's something that's to be rejected. But what he really wants to do is have Emerson, Chandra, and Parker and these people read Bhagavatam and chant Hare Krishna, right? Yeah, sure. But, whatever there that they have is true and good and valuable, accept it. And Maharaj in the back. No, now he waves away the mic. No, it's okay. Anything else or any other questions from this? Yeah. We're just winding up now.
Just wanted to ask one question. I actually wanted to ask this question 4 years ago. You gave a Bhagavatam class here in Radhadesh, and you were speaking about this, your decision when you were between these two worldviews, Madhavana and the Vaishnava. Did you refer, when you were speaking about this, to the exact point between when you did not know whether to turn this side or that side? Because for me it seems like there is some reason, some rational cause for accept Vaishnava philosophy.
Oh, lots of them.
So the way you refer to the sutras, also that means, does that mean that in that state one simply takes Vaishnava faith as another, as a reflection of modern faith, in the same way as it's a fundamentalistic view of the Vaishnava philosophy, and therefore one cannot see this rational principles.
I really don't understand your question. I'm sorry.
You said today that between this, when you made the decision, this was actually a vacuum, so to say.
No grounds for making
the
decision.
Yes.
Once you've decided on what grounds you make the decision, you found you're already in one camp or the other.
Yeah. But is it not possible to step out of this
attitude
and
find a third ground that doesn't belong to either two camps? Well, you can find it. Fine, I can't.
The creation consciousness is this, so to say, third ground, but...
It isn't the third ground. It's one of the other two.
It's not the first...
What is the third ground? Now I want to know, should I choose Krishna consciousness or should I choose Maya? Or the modern world? Well, I think I should choose Krishna consciousness because at least whatever I do will have an eternal result. Well, I've already accepted Krishna consciousness to have that as a reason. Because the other guru would say, if you accept Krishna consciousness, you'll have the pie in the sky when you die. It's an illusion, you know. So go on, tell me all the reasons you could accept it. And you'll find that you belong to one camp or another. If I say, well, I accept it because it may not be true, but at least it'll give morality. Then I've actually chosen the other camp. And you're going to have Krishna conscious, sort of, you know. It just seems to me at that time I couldn't find any neutral position.
But it seems that the reasons in Krishna consciousness are at the same time neutral and
Oh, once I've accepted Krishna consciousness, yeah, sure. That is perfectly reasonable and it's totally rational. And it's based on certain fundamental things that I'm absolutely convinced are true beyond any... and I have no right to be so certain. That's true. From a critical perspective of knowledge, I have no right to be as certain as I am. But I'm absolutely certain. And I know where that certainty comes from. It's a gift of God. Now, is that allowed or not? I don't know. Anyway, that's the best I can explain it. I think probably it's. Did anybody from? Yeah, I think somebody had a hand up over there. Yeah, sure. Well, okay. We'll do two more.
Prabhu, can you say that it is the prerogative of the acharya to adapt or to interpret the deep knowledge according to time and circumstances, to spread transcendental knowledge? And if the answer is yes, then can we say that there may be now some people who would need the kind of approach that Bhaktivinoda Thakur used before?
Is it needed? Well, you know, if I were trying to function as an academic within an academic department, that's like deciding, okay, I'm going to play a game by certain rules, and you could play that game by certain rules. You could do that. You could take something like a Bhaktivinoda Thakur approach, and I think I would know how to do it without particularly compromising my Krishna consciousness by simply saying, according to the tradition, blah, blah, blah. But according to modern scholarship, blah, blah, blah. Now, when I follow this out, you know, and I could just do it. I could play the game by their rules. But because I'm playing the game by their rules, doesn't mean that I think it's the, you know, ultimate game. So you can do that. You can go in that context. Because really, it's true. Because what would count in Krishna consciousness is a valid reason for accepting something, such as the authority of Krishna or Prabhupada, will not count at all. Will not count at all in academics. And you know, in anything that we say, you know, about religious history may not count at all either. It's a different ground rules. So if you were going to be in an academic department and want to publish and continue, if there are reasons to do that, and but I would only do that until I could start to change them. That's the other thing. If you want to prevail, first of all, you have to survive.
You don't think Bhaktivinoda Thakur's approach could help them progress?
Bhaktivinoda Thakur's approach? Ultimately, no. Ultimately. First of all, by the way, everything he says, by the way, about history is now obsolete, you know. It definitely was the currently a fashionable opinion because it's now completely obsolete. He talks about the Aryan invasion. Now the Adunadika Vada says there wasn't one. Shukabak's approach. I think the way he reconciles the two for me it would compromise my commitments to Srila Prabhupada. And I think if it compromised my commitment to Srila Prabhupada, I wouldn't be good for anybody. I think there's some way that I could work in a department of religion without doing that compromise, but it wouldn't be with the same kind of making these divisions between the phenomenal and the transcendental. I don't think that can be done myself. So now you have a disagreement between two scholars. Well, what else is new? Yes, that's right.
And the other question was about the creationists. Some devotees in the States were very happy because in certain schools the Darwin theory was banished. So I want to know what is the position on this issue, because the creationists are sometimes assimilated to fundamentalists and to stupid people, and Krishna consciousness is supposed to be a very rational and scientific method.
Sure.
So, do we support their position?
Depends on which devotee you talk to. This will have to be the last question because it's getting late, because this does get a little involved. But I should tell you. Yeah.
cutting edge of that stuff in our society is through the Karma Guru. Mm-hmm. And he's discovered, the person who's on the cutting edge of that stuff in our society is through the Karma Guru. And he's discovered that there's a whole new set of anti-Dharmans who are far beyond the primitive creation.
And I discovered it. You know where I discovered it? The front page of the New York Times last month. I mean, this is what's happened. The same argument, you know, when Prabhupada told me, you know, defeat Darwin, and I said, I have to take this seriously. Fortunately, you know, within a year I met Sataputta before his days of renown, and we sat down, and he says, yeah, it's wrong. And he believed it was wrong before he became a devotee. And he showed me by mathematical arguments and reasons and other things that it couldn't possibly work in principle. And those very same arguments have now received, as Maharaj is telling us, a great deal of effort, a great deal of support now among biologists and people who are not fundamentalist Christians. Our very same approach. And this was on the front page of the New York Times because they were talking about these freaked out evolutionists, you know, because it was easy to dismiss the Christians because then you had to believe the world was created, you know, 5,000 years ago and stuff like that, you know. But these arguments, the evolutionists said, were much more insidious and difficult to deal with. So that's the kind of thing I think that right now that our platform is on. In other words, what Prabhupada was saying to do is happening. Darwin is going down. It's happening. The ISKCON devotees had a lot to do with it. We have been in communications with these people. We have been talking to them. At one point, at the very beginning, with the BI, we were going to work together with the Christians. We thought, well, let's see if we have a common cause. So we wrote to the head of the Creation Research Institute, which is their big thing, saying, you know, we may be from different positions, but we all agree that evolution is wrong and that God created the universe. Maybe we can work together. The answer was back, no, you're of the devil. Unless you accept Jesus in your heart as your personal Savior, we cannot work together. And that was it. So we have not worked with them. And their approach has not found favor, but the same approach that Sataputta and others have been taking has gradually gone. Because when you look at evolution from an actual rational point of view, it doesn't work. It could not. Not only didn't it happen, it could not have happened in any possible universe. So, stay tuned. So I think what Prabhupada's project is. You won't have to do what Bhaktivinoda Thakur did to get a hearing. You know. All right, we better stop now. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your participation. And by the way, I have to keep working on this topic. Shonaka Rishi does want an article from me on this matter, scriptural understanding, for the ISKCON Communication Journal. I would appreciate any feedback that you have to offer me. You know, Ravindra.
At CompuServe So further questions or things you think need to be improved on or
areas that still have doubt or whatever suggestions, please, you know, drop me a line and I can use it as I work up this material further. I hope Krishna gives me the time to do it. So I much appreciate your help and your participation. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.